KQED News with Brian Watt coming up at 6:59. Back to Peter for another look at traffic.
Interstate 280, San Mateo County, just getting word of a crash. Southbound 280 connector ramp to eastbound 92. No details yet. Hopefully we'll have more on that for you next time around. And in Oakland, we still have a conked out vehicle on the connector ramp, westbound 580 to eastbound 980, blocking the second lane from the left. Peter Finch for KQED.
And support for KQED comes from Biocom California, bringing the life science and tech sectors together to shape the future of healthcare at the inaugural Converge Summit on May 22nd in South San Francisco. Visit biocom.org/converge. Thank you for visiting us, and thanks for listening. You're on KQED FM 88.5 San Francisco and KQEI FM 89.3 North Highlands, Sacramento, live online at kqed.org. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning. Now 7 a.m.
Good morning. Senators will try again on a border bill. A bipartisan proposal already died once. Now Democrats plan an election year vote as Donald Trump's followers push back. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, activists at USF agreed to clear out their pro-Palestinian camp by now.
Who are the new leaders of the National Rifle Association? I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In this hour, we hear who's taking over the group after a jury found the previous leader used NRA contributions to support his lifestyle. Also, how does Israel answer accusations by the International Criminal Court? And will my mom get to cheer on the Indiana Pacers to the NBA Finals? We have an assessment. It's Tuesday, May 21st. This day in 1542, the Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto died near the Mississippi River. He explored the future U.S. but never found the gold he was looking for. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The International Criminal Court is weighing its next steps as it seeks arrest warrants for Israeli leaders and members of the Palestinian militant group Hamas. The chief prosecutor for the ICC on Monday accused both sides of war crimes amid the war in Gaza. Judge Chile Boasuji is the former president of the International Criminal Court. He told NPR's Morning Edition that a final decision is still pending.
It isn't a done deal. It's up to the judges. There'll be three judges who review the application and the materials tendered in support of the application, and then they'll make a decision.
President Biden blasted the ICC's decision, calling it outrageous. He also reaffirmed Israel's right to defend itself against Hamas. A dozen people accused of taking part in a scheme to undermine President Biden's victory in Arizona in the 2020 election are scheduled to appear in court for the first time today. Wayne Shutsky from member station KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
A grand jury indictment alleged participants in the so-called fake elector scheme sought to deliver Arizona's 11 electoral votes to former President Donald Trump. 12 defendants in the case, including Trump attorneys Jenna Ellis and Christina Bobb, are among those scheduled to appear in Maricopa County Superior Court. A spokesman for Arizona's attorney general says Rudy Giuliani, who was just served an indictment on Friday, is also expected in court unless a judge grants him a delay. 9 of the 11 so-called fake electors who signed a document falsely claiming Trump won are also expected to appear, including former Arizona Republican Party Chairwoman Kelly Ward and State Senator Anthony Kern. For NPR News, I'm Wayne Shutsky in Phoenix.
Stocks on Wall Street opened mixed this morning as some big retailers reported better-than-expected quarterly profits. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 43 points in early trading.
Department store giant Macy's says both sales and profits declined in the most recent quarter, but the slump was not as bad as analysts had expected. Macy's also raised its forecast for future sales, giving the company's stock a boost. The home improvement chain Lowe's also outperformed Wall Street's low expectations. Home and garden center saw a jump in spending last month, even as overall retail sales were flat. Federal Reserve Governor Chris Waller says he's hopeful progress on inflation is back on track, though Waller cautions he'll need to see more good data before voting to lower interest rates. The former college professor gave last week's report showing lower inflation a grade of C+, saying it's far from failing, but not stellar either. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks continuing to trade mixed on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow is up 44 points, the Nasdaq Composite down 25. This is NPR News. in Washington.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt in San Francisco. Pro-Palestinian activists camped out at the University of San Francisco since last month have agreed to clear out by this hour as students leave for the summer. Hannah Beauchamp-Pope is a first-year law student.
As people move into the summer and students are going home, like me myself, I'm going to the South for my legal internship. We need to adjust our strategy and how we're pushing for our demands. Taking down our encampment isn't because we're satisfied. It's simply because we're being strategic in the way that we're going to adjust.
USF workers began removing some tents at the camp Monday, but stopped after students objected. Students say they plan to donate the tents to unhoused people. The Richmond City Council plans to discuss a proposal this afternoon to place an oil refining tax on an upcoming ballot. KQED's Laura Clivens has more.
Mayor Eduardo Martinez is proposing the tax to address a projected budget shortfall and what he calls the Chevron refinery's negative impacts. Those include premature deaths due to particulate matter in the air and millions in annual health care costs. The city is forecasting a $34 million deficit for the coming fiscal year and additional deficits over the next five. Richmond voters passed a tax on refineries in 2008 that was struck down in court. Community groups backing this renewed effort say the city can resolve those legal issues this time around. I'm Laura Clivens, KQED News.
In sports, the Giants play the Pirates in Pittsburgh this afternoon. The A's host the Rockies this evening. And the Oakland Ballers open their season and existence against the Glacier Range Riders in Flathead Valley, Montana. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from San Francisco Opera. The American premiere of Kaija Saariaho's Innocence runs this June, sfopera.com. Support for NPR comes from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And the listeners of KQED. Peter Finch with traffic now at 7:06 out in San Mateo County.
We do have more information on this crash that had just come in last time we talked to you. This is on the connector southbound 280 to eastbound 92. Two SUVs mixed it up. The good news, they're both on the right shoulder, so no lanes are blocked there. New crash in San Jose southbound 880 before Bascom Avenue. That crash, though, also on the right shoulder. Peter Finch for KQED.
Traffic support for Peter Finch comes to us from Murphy McKenna Construction. More KQED news on this Tuesday morning with Brian Watt. Ahead at 8:22, California Forever has a big vision proposing a new city in Solano County. And the company says the future city would create thousands of new jobs. So what kind of jobs? Hear more at 8:22, right here on listener-supported KQED. More nice weather, sunshine, warmer temperatures, especially inland today around the Bay and the Sacramento Valley. Bay Area highs, 60s to the upper 80s. Mostly clear tonight, coast and bay, no forecast of fog. As far as we can tell, lows in the upper 40s to the mid-50s tonight and overnight. Today, Sacramento Valley, lots of sun and warmer. Highs will range from 82 to 90 degrees.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. How does Israel respond to a move by the International Criminal Court? The court's chief prosecutor says he will seek arrest warrants for leaders of Hamas and leaders of Israel, including the prime minister and defense minister. Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, Ron Dermer, joins us now. He's also part of Israel's war cabinet. Minister Dermer, welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you again, Steve.
The former president of the ICC was on this program today, and we asked, why would you seek warrants against Israel? Why seek warrants for leaders of this democracy? And he said, quote, no one is above the law. Would you agree with him up to that point?
Certainly no one is above the law, including the prosecutor of the ICC, because the ICC has no jurisdiction over Israel, and it has no jurisdiction over any of these cases. I mean, the substance of the charges are completely false, but he also has no jurisdiction, and that's just not what Israel says. It's what nearly every serious European country has said. It's what the American State Department has said, because we're not signatories to it, and the Palestinians are not a state. You know, a lot of people are talking about what should happen in a solution. Should they be a state or not a state? The ICC has regarded them a state in order to get jurisdiction and essentially to bring these war crimes charges against Israel.
Let's talk about civilian casualties. I know there's a
dispute about numbers. Israel has given its own numbers, acknowledged about 30,000 dead, about 14,000 believed to be Hamas fighters, 16,000 civilians. There are other counts, but this is Israel's counts. A majority of civilians dead, 16,000. Was it impossible to avoid any of those casualties?
Look, Steve, you've had experts on urban warfare, including the leading expert at West Point, including a General Petraeus, who said no country has taken such great measures to keep the civilians of the enemy population out of harm's way. This is exactly what we've done. And the laws of war are very clear. You have to have distinction, you have to have proportionality, and you have to give warning and precaution to get out of areas. That's exactly what Israel's done. No country has operated, I think, and taken such great lengths to keep the civilians out of harm's way. So this charge is totally false. The other charge that is the main charge of the case against us is that we have a policy of starvation. Steve, you mentioned it at the beginning. I'm in the War Cabinet. We do not have such a policy. We've never had such a policy.
Although you do have a policy of closing border crossings and keeping supplies from going into Gaza, don't you?
No.
We have actually put in a half a million tons.
It's not been the policy. The policy is to ensure from the beginning that Gazans would have their basic humanitarian needs met. That is international law, and we have comported with international law from the beginning. We have had 20,000 trucks move into Gaza. We have paved roads and opened passages to get more trucks into Gaza. You know who has not done that? Hamas has actually attacked the border crossings. They did it a couple of weeks ago, right after the American Secretary of State was here. They're stealing the aid. Israel is pushing the aid in. They're stealing the aid, and we're the ones that are being hit by these war crimes charges. It's absurd. They've created this false equivalence between Israel and Hamas, which would be bad enough. It's like taking FDR and Hitler or President Bush and Osama bin Laden. You know, both of them are wrong.
And
that's
you're correct.
It's important for your listeners to understand, Steve. The charges are utterly false. We have never had a policy of starving the population.
I'm going to move on to the next point here. Minister Dermer, if I can, forgive me. I want to be sure that we have time to get a couple of questions on the table here. You mentioned earlier that you have warned civilians to move out of certain areas, and that is true that you have issued such warnings, but then you've moved into those areas. In fact, Israeli troops now are moving into parts of Rafah, which is where people had taken shelter. Does Israel take responsibility for civilian lives in Rafah, the more than a million people who are there now?
We do everything to avoid civilian casualties. There's not more than a million people. You got to get updated on your show. 950,000 people have already left Rafah because we put evacuation orders. Most armies that are trying to target civilians don't drop millions of leaflets and make phone calls to get people out of harm's way. You have cases of tragedies in warfare. You remember the case of three of our hostages came out and they were accidentally fired upon by our own troops. You have those cases. We have lost dozens of soldiers because of friendly fire. That's unfortunate. The tragedy of warfare. But Israel has gone to lengths that no other army has to keep Palestinian civilians out of harm's way. And for them to bring these charges, for the prosecutor, which is effectively a rogue prosecutor because he doesn't have jurisdiction, which I think is something that the White House and the State Department made clear, for him to bring this case against Israel is really outrageous and dangerous.
One very quick question, if I can, Minister Dermer. If the warrants are issued, because a panel of judges still has to rule on this, if the warrants are issued, will Israel press countries to disregard them and allow your officials to travel?
Well, of course, and I think the United States, Britain, Germany, and other countries should disregard it. I hope that the judges don't make that decision and don't essentially undermine the credibility of the ICC, because it will be seen as a kangaroo court.
Ron Dermer is Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs. Thank you for taking the time, sir.
Thank you.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv. He's covered this war from the beginning, covered Israel for years, and he's been listening into our conversation. Daniel, let's just pick up on a couple of assertions made there. We asked about the charge of starvation, starving people in Gaza. Ron Dermer says they're allowing in a lot of aid. What are you seeing?
Well, the United Nations itself has said children have died from malnutrition in Gaza. Several thousand kids, it says, have been diagnosed with malnutrition in addition. And when I spoke to a former senior Israeli official about this issue, he said, you know, Israel its military is occupying Gaza now and has an obligation to ensure food and aid. So the minister is saying that Israel is flooding aid. I would say that even the United States would dispute that description. The U.S. has called on Israel and saying it needs to do much more to ensure aid gets into Gaza.
He also said, listen, we've warned civilians to get out of the way. I guess it is true that warnings have been made. What is the practical effect of that on the ground?
Well, the practical effect is that even though Israel has not launched its major Rafah operation yet, and that's a dispute with the United States, more than 900,000 Palestinians have fled Rafah to areas in Gaza that are already overcrowded with very bad conditions. And it's just for the experience of people on the ground, they don't feel like anywhere is safe. Israel's bombardments and airstrikes do continue, with women and children killed even just in the last few days, according to health officials.
What are the facts on jurisdiction? He says the court has no jurisdiction. He's right. The U.S. State Department has said there's no jurisdiction here, but what's the broader picture?
Well, it is a matter of dispute. Israel and the U.S. say that they have no jurisdiction in the court because Israel is not a party to the court. But the Palestinian Authority leadership did join the court some years ago. And the ICC prosecutor himself has said that crimes committed on Palestinian territory by any party could fall under the court's jurisdiction.
Just got a few seconds left, but what have the talk of this arrest warrant done politically in Israel for Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister?
Well, a vast majority of lawmakers in Israel's parliament have signed a declaration saying that Israel's army is the most moral in the world and rejecting this move.
Okay. NPR's Daniel Estrin, thanks very much for the perspective. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The Democratic-led Senate will vote on border legislation again this week.
Yeah, they'll vote on the same bipartisan bill that failed to pass earlier this year. Republicans at that time blocked their own bill at the urging of their presidential candidate, Donald Trump, who is campaigning on immigration. So now the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer, plans another vote as we head into election season.
The Senate will vote on our bipartisan border bill on Thursday. All those who say we need to act on the border will get a chance this week to show they're serious, serious about fixing the border.
NPR's congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales joins us to discuss. Good morning.
Good morning, Leila.
So, Claudia, why revisit the bill now?
It's a reflection of what's become a top issue for the national electorate now and the critical role it will play in this year's election. Senate Democrats want to put Republicans on record. They were once pushing for exactly this kind of legislation, but quickly revolted after a bipartisan group put out the final plan in February. And this came after months of negotiations on both sides. And as we know, this bill would have tightened rules for asylum and given the president authority to shut down the border. At the time of the negotiations for this bill, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said that this was the best deal Republicans could get, even if they controlled the White House and both chambers of Congress.
Is there any role here for President Biden to weigh in?
The White House said Biden spoke with Republican leaders yesterday to encourage them to join Democrats to pass this legislation and to stop playing politics. That said, the White House is not ruling out possible executive actions Biden could pursue at the border.
Obviously, Democrats are expected to vote for the plan. What about Republicans?
Well, they're still expected to vote against it. And that includes one of the original Republican authors of the border bipartisan bill. Oklahoma's James Lankford slammed the plan on the floor recently, saying this vote is part of a partisan messaging war.
Listen, if we're going to solve the border issues, it's not going to be by doing competing messaging bills. If we're going to solve this, let's sit down like adults and let's figure out how we're going to actually resolve this together.
He went on to say that this vote is simply a way to try to, quote, poke Republicans in the eye. He argued the American people will see right through this as a politically driven effort and asked, more importantly, why Congress is not fixing the issue.
And what's happening with border legislation in the Republican-led House?
There is not much happening when we look at the bipartisan angle there. Both parties are simply working on their own plans. House Speaker Mike Johnson is focused on partisan border bills that only have support from his own Republican Party. Meanwhile, House Democrats were looking to build a bipartisan border task force and focus on a series of initiatives, but that plan appears to be on ice. So it's a reminder of the many challenges to getting anything substantive done done on this issue from Congress and how it's largely focused on messaging to win key battleground districts now, especially worried about immigration.
NPR's congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales. Thank you, Claudia.
Thank you much.
This is NPR News.
On listener-supported KQED for Tuesday. Good morning, I'm Dave Freeman at 7:19. Peter Finch returns with a look at the freeways and roads ahead.
Starting at the Bay Bridge, where a fender bender at the toll plaza has been cleared to the west parking lot. Pretty slow coming into the city, though, this morning. The drive time right now from the Mays to Fremont Street is 35 minutes. Oakland, a conked out vehicle on the connector ramp, westbound 580 to eastbound 980, has now been cleared from the roadway. Peter Finch for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from Live Nation, presenting Jacob Collier at Bill Graham Civic Auditorium this Thursday, May 23rd, with special guest Kimbra. Tickets are on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. Brevo, helping businesses work smarter, not harder, to help deliver customer experiences across email, SMS, WhatsApp, web push notification, chat, and more. Learn more at brevo.com. That's brevo.com. More Morning Edition ahead. Wisconsin is one of a handful of pivotal states in the 2024 presidential election. Within the swing state, there are swing counties that could decide the election even as people remain divided. That election story coming up on KQED. Later this morning, don't forget Forum from 9 to 11.
I'm Mina Kim. Next time on Forum, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof has reported from war zones amid humanitarian crises and delved into our own nation's struggles with poverty, addiction, and homelessness. And yet, in his new memoir, Chasing Hope, Kristof calls himself an optimist. We'll talk to Kristof about how he inspires action through storytelling. Join us Forum 10 a.m. here on KQED.
Weather-wise, Bay Area lots of sun again today, and Sacramento as well. Bay Area highs in the 60s to the upper 80s. Clear skies tonight, lows 40s and 50s. Sunny tomorrow. Sacramento Valley with the sun today. Highs will range from 82 to 90. A little cooler tomorrow, 81 to about 88. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, a fiber supplement containing psyllium, a plant-based fiber for trapping and removing waste in the digestive system. Designed to be taken every day. More at metamucil.com. And the Schizophrenia and Psychosis Action Alliance, working to shatter barriers to treatment, survival, and recovery so that people with schizophrenia can recover and thrive. Learn more at WeCanThrive.org. And the listeners, members, and sustainers of KQED.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We think of ourselves as so divided as a country, so divided by place, red states, blue states, but there are places that change. One of them is Wisconsin, which has gone both ways in recent years. And in Wisconsin are some pivot counties. These are places that voted for former President Obama a couple of times and then flipped to former President Trump in 2016. In the suburbs of Madison, two of those counties happened to neighbor each other, and one stuck with Trump in 2020 while one bounced back to Biden. NPR's Elena Moore went to both.
On a recent Tuesday morning in Portage, Wisconsin, Sharon Wade was helping her friend Sandra with a new project, sprucing up her old dresser.
You're going to be fine, Sandy. I promise you. You know you can call me if you need to.
Spritzer, yeah. Water.
Wade runs a craft and antique furnishing store downtown. She says recently, business has been slow.
It's been difficult to see people come in that were regulars before that bought, and now they just come in to look. And I don't blame them. You get in that situation where you have to buy things that you need, not necessarily what you want.
She's concerned about rising prices, and protecting her business drives her vote. In 2016 and 2020, she supported former President Donald Trump. Before that, she voted twice for former President Barack Obama. Now, she says she's supporting President Biden. And though Wade doesn't regret voting for Trump, Trump, his legal woes are a deal breaker.
I just feel like there's so much going on with his life that how can he focus on our country? So I think that's part of it for me is just we need someone who's going to be dedicated to what's happening for us.
Wade's voting history mirrors her home of Columbia County. Located less than an hour outside Madison, Columbia has both city commuters and people in more rural small towns. It's a place that's gone back and forth in presidential elections. And it's far from the only one. Nearby is Sauk County.
Large iced chocolate chai, one shot with skim, and then
Jen Gamble Thomas sits in a coffee shop in downtown Baraboo, the largest town in Sauk.
I think that everybody I know knows who they're voting for.
With a few slightly bigger towns, the county has a similar makeup to Columbia, and it's also incredibly politically divided. Gamble Thomas, who works with a local veterinarian, is a Democrat.
People have solidified what their values are and what they'd like to see happen. I think everybody's holding true to where they stand.
Sauk and Columbia are two of over 20 counties in Wisconsin that voted for Obama twice and then flipped to Trump 8 years ago. But in 2020, Sauk voted for Biden and Columbia voted for Trump. Both by less than 2 percentage points. Two of the tightest margins in Wisconsin, a state Biden narrowly won last time and that Trump won in 2016. Mark Calloway sits a few tables away from Gamble Thomas. The real estate investor says he's a Trump supporter and actually moved from Illinois to Wisconsin in part because of the 50-50 nature of the state.
I like the fairness of it. At least here it's flip of the coin, yeah.
And the coin toss is consequential. In nearby Rock Springs, a town of 300 people, the Sauk County Republicans meet in a repurposed bank with walls covered in campaign posters.
It's not red. It's not blue. It's purple.
County Chairman Jerry Helmer. The group has made a tradition of gathering for coffee once a week to talk community and, of course, politics.
I see that the Republicans are more excited and more wound up than I have ever seen them.
People now have seen the alternative. They've seen what Biden has done. They've seen what the Democrats are doing. They've seen the impact.
That's Sauk County Republican Gordon Stotts. The group says the election is a referendum on Biden's handling of issues like the economy and the border.
To me, Joe Biden is doing more campaigning for Trump than Trump is for himself. He's laying the stage for here's what happens if you don't elect someone that has our country's real benefits in mind.
But Democrats in the county say they too know the stakes.
Hello. Come in.
A few members of the Sauk County Dems sip coffee in Baraboo. And when organizer Judy Bry goes out canvassing, those are the same issues voters want to talk about.
The border and immigration and cost of living over and over and over again. They say our president is doing nothing about it. I'm not going to vote for him.
But that's what our job is that those low information voters, those are the ones that we have to make sure that we're contacting, which you're
That's
doing,
the voice of Susan Noer, the chair of the Sauk County Democrats. Noer says they're hoping to engage with voters over issues like protecting abortion access, a topic she argues can bring in more women and young voters. So she worries less about Trump gaining ground, but
my concern would be if people would just stay home. And I think that's what we are promoting, is a no vote is a vote for Trump.
And with margins as tight as they've been in the last two presidential elections, staying home can also be a swing vote. And Sauk and neighboring Columbia are swing counties in a swing state, meaning campaigns are looking there for every single vote. And though so many people are already decided, some voters do remain unsure, especially because it's another Trump-Biden rematch.
I'm not voting for that reason alone. I feel like there shouldn't be 80-year-old men running our country.
Marissa Flick eats lunch with her family at a diner in Baraboo. She's a caretaker for her sister and has an 18-month-old son. She voted for Biden last time, partially because her mom told her to. She disagrees with some of Trump's rhetoric on immigration, but generally, she just feels disconnected from the whole race.
I don't really know what to look for. I feel like every time you see like a video of someone, they're always just bashing the other side, not saying like, oh, what they're going to do to make the country better.
She says if someone explained more about the election, giving her good enough reasons, she'd be open to voting for Biden again. Back over in Columbia County, local artist Kathleen Yon isn't enthusiastic either.
Nobody's grabbing my heart.
Though she says Trump had some good policies, she can't trust him anymore. At the same time, she isn't sold on Biden.
he's got a lot of good ideas and he wants to help a lot of the people, but I think sometimes he's not doing it in the correct way.
And in a place where the political stakes are so high, it's hard to be undecided. That's why Jan has a rule.
I personally, when I get together with people, say we're here to enjoy ourselves. We will not talk about politics or religion. Sorry.
A tough ask in a swing county. Elena Moore, NPR News.
You hear Elena's reporting on Morning Edition from NPR News.
And right now on KQED, we talk traffic with Peter Finch at 729.
Traffic remains pretty slow coming into the city over the Bay Bridge right now. The drive time from the Mays to Fremont Street is 35 minutes with some backup there at the toll plaza. Oakland westbound 580, the connector ramp to eastbound 980, completely clear following an earlier stall. San Mateo Highland, southbound 280, connector ramp to eastbound 92. A crash there is on the right shoulder. Peter Finch for KQED.
Traffic support from European Sleepworks and support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. And Xfinity offering wall-to-wall Wi-Fi coverage throughout the house with Xfinity. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. I'm Dave Freeman on KQED. Good morning. It's 7:30.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The California Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments later today in a contentious case that could decide the fate of the gig economy. KQED's Rachel Miro has more from our Silicon Valley desk.
App-based gig companies have bankrolled efforts to reshape California labor law in the legislature, at the ballot box, and in the courts. They say gig work offers independent contractors essential freedom and flexibility. But labor unions and many local governments say that Uber, Lyft, and others are shifting their labor costs to the workers themselves, as well as to customers and taxpayers. The arguments before the state Supreme Court this week will focus on a clause in Proposition 22 that a lower court judge has said limits state lawmakers' constitutional power to enforce workers' compensation in California. But this decision could set a national precedent. I'm Rachel Miro, KQED News.
About 2,000 UC Santa Cruz graduate student workers went on strike yesterday. It's the first action in a statewide response by their union, the UAW, to the UC's handling of campus protests over the Israel-Hamas war. Jeremiah Edding is news director at KAZU on the Central Coast. He says the striking workers have a number of demands.
Things like divesting from businesses that support Israel, either with military contracts or manufacturing, and also disclosing funding sources so that researchers on campus know where their money's coming from and what those funding sources are invested in.
UC says the UAW's contract does not allow strikes over non-labor issues. Thousands of low-income San Francisco seniors may soon get help paying the rent under a proposed amendment to the city charter that's being introduced today. KQED's Sarah Hosseini reports.
Board of Supervisors President Aaron Peskin, who's running for mayor in November, says his plan would increase rent subsidies for elders in affordable housing by $33 million by 2030. Jen Fujioka is policy director at the Chinatown Community Development Center. He describes the lack of city resources for many older visitors to the group's housing clinic as soul-crushing.
We cannot have a system where our lowest rents are actually equal to the median income of seniors in the city. That makes no sense.
The charter amendment would appear on the November ballot and requires a simple majority for approval. I'm Sarah Hosseini, KQED News.
Marin County has seen a small drop in homelessness. Newly released results of a point-in-time count done in January found a nearly 3% decrease in the overall number of unhoused people compared to 2022. Larger declines were seen in some groups. The number of homeless families with children is down 12%. chronically homeless individuals, 24%, and unhoused veterans, down 32%. County officials say the decrease comes despite efforts to include around 85 people living in farm encampments in West Marin who were left out of previous counts. They had been categorized as living in farm worker housing in the past. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Coming up on Morning Edition on KQED, Steve Inskeep talks about the NBA playoffs with Jesse Washington, a senior writer at ESPN's Landscape.
Coming up on the California Report, the Golden State is considered key when it comes to Democrats' ambitions to reclaim a majority in the House of Representatives. But in one hotly contested congressional race, many young progressive voters are wondering if they should even cast a ballot.
People saying that they are not interested in voting, they have to be taken seriously.
Voter dismay in one California congressional district. I'm Saul Gonzalez. That's coming up on the California Report.
Next hour. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Indeed.com/NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The National Rifle Association is getting new leaders. They take over after a corruption case in which jurors found that the NRA's longtime CEO used millions of the nonprofit's dollars for himself. So who's in charge now? Mike Spies is a senior staff writer for The Trace, a nonprofit that covers gun-related news. Good morning. Thanks for being on the program.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So the NRA board has chosen Doug Hamlin to replace Wayne LaPierre as CEO and executive vice president, and former Georgia Congressman Bob Barr will be the organization's new president. What can you tell us about them?
Well, Barr is interesting because he was a former congressman, as you pointed out. In the early or in the late 90s, he was actually responsible for bringing the NRA the idea that the gun industry should have liability immunity from lawsuits, which is probably the most significant piece of gun legislation that has passed Congress in the last 30 years, besides the Brady Bill. Mm. Having said that, I don't really think that as president, he's going to have much of a dramatic effect since the position is largely ceremonial and no one knows who he is. And Doug Hamlin, who's taking over the extremely high-profile role of executive vice president, is the same issue. Right? No one knows who he is. He led publications for a long time. He's theoretically somehow painted as a reform, or was or painted as a reform candidate, but there's nothing actually reform about Doug.
Hmm. So you're saying really these new leaders aren't much reformers, really. So what do these choices tell us about where the NRA is heading?
I think it really suggests that the NRA is lost. It's hard to really say exactly why they went with these particular candidates, except that I suspect it does, at least to the industry, project some measure of stability. And maybe that's the most important thing for the organization right now, coming off of the trial and all the things that have continued to go wrong for it. But I also think, you know, choosing, for lack of a better phrase, two old white men does not really point the way forward, especially for, you know, the organization needs, if it's going to sustain itself, young people, needs women, people of color, stuff that it's internally acknowledged, and this certainly doesn't help it achieve those goals.
Yeah. Is it going to sustain itself? I mean, the NRA has been dealing with scandals, legal issues. How has it affected its political power?
It will continue to exist as a brand, the way many things that have been around for a really long time continue to exist as a brand. And I think it will continue to get by on fumes in that regard. But do I think its political influence is in any way meaningful right now or will be again? No, not really. I mean, I do think, obviously, Republican leaders find it useful to be able to go to the convention, reach people, you know, there's some value in that, but as far as being able to influence elections and that sort of thing, I mean, I think the issue has become so binary that its purpose is, it just really doesn't have one anymore. I mean, its best days are behind it.
That's Mike Spies, senior staff writer for The Trace. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
My mom and I watched the Indiana Pacers defeat the New York Knicks on Sunday. Okay, we weren't at the game at Madison Square Garden. We weren't even in the same room, but we were on the phone and texting as we watched Game 7 on TV. The Pacers got ahead, they stayed ahead, and they beat the Knicks by 21 points. Tonight, the Pacers face the top-seeded Boston Celtics as we begin one of two conference championships that we'll discuss with Jesse Washington, who's with the sports and pop culture site Andscape and a regular here. Jesse, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Okay, so I'm a journalist. I'm just going to cover the game straight, but secretly I'll be pulling for the Pacers. Do they have a shot tonight?
No, they do not. You know, nice scrappy bunch of players there. They're coming off a gritty seven-game series. They had to fight for every inch against the scrappy New York Knicks.
Mm-hmm.
The Celtics have been chilling with their feet up, getting rested, hopefully getting their center, Kristaps Porzingis, more healthy to play. But even without KP at the five spot, the Celtics are just too good, man. We've all known they're going to the finals pretty much all season. They had the best record in the NBA this year. And the Pacers might take a game or two off them in a seven-game series, but it's going to be tough.
Okay, I'm going to call you back if you're wrong. But in any case,
hey, I'm here for it.
Let's think about the style. I mean, I was watching this game, the Pacers and the Knicks. It was a super physical game. It's rough, as it often is with the New York Knicks, and the Pacers have traditionally been that kind of team, too. Are the Celtics the same? Are they that kind of getting an elbow in your face kind of team?
Yeah, man, they got an edge to them, you know. Jaylen Brown, big, tough wing. Jason Tatum, superstar, no softy. Derek White, very scrappy. Jrue Holiday, probably the best guard defender in the league. You know, and the Pacers, really, they've had great offense all season. And Tyrese Halliburton, their point guard, is an emerging superstar in this league. But the Pacers also have good defense. So, you know, the Celtics, it's going to be physical, as it always is in the playoffs. These guys play so hard on every possession. And for anybody who complains about the NBA being lackadaisical during the regular season, this is what we wait for.
Yeah.
These games where they, the best athletes in the world, playing as hard as they can, it's amazing to watch.
All right, out west, the Dallas Mavericks take on the Minnesota Timberwolves. That's the other conference championship. How does that match look?
Yeah, you know, it looks exciting. And we got the most exciting young player in the league, Anthony Edwards. I mean, this guy, everybody's talking about him, and for good reason. But the rest of his team is balling out, too. Karl Anthony Towns, a number one draft pick way back in the 2000s. He's having a great game. Anthony Edwards doesn't have to play great to win. And on the other side, that's the difference. The Mavericks, Luka Doncic, the superstar, he's got to play great for them to win. Kyrie Irving, he's got to play great for them to win. And Luka's been banged up, you know. He's had a tough postseason. He's dealing with some injuries, as a lot of guys are this time of year. But the matchup is going to be very exciting because we got a whole new crop of guys to watch this late in the playoffs. Usually it's LeBron and Steph and these guys. No, sir, not this year. We got Ant, we got Luka, we got Kat. That's the way it's going
to
go.
When you say Anthony Edwards, we're talking about the star of a team, the Timberwolves, that has never been to the NBA Finals. Could this be their year?
This will be their year. You could book it. 4-2. I got the Wolves over the Dallas Mavericks. The Timberwolves, for the first time, will go to the NBA Finals.
Okay, Jesse Washington is on the radio, and we're recording on tape with his predictions for the conference finals. Always a pleasure talking with you, sir. Thank you so much.
Great to be here. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Right here on KQED, time again to check on your Bay Area ride with Peter Finch.
We're seeing some slow stretches of traffic right now. Carquinez Bridge to the Maze, westbound 80. The drive time is 44 minutes. Westbound Highway 4, slow going Leverage Road to past Willow Pass Road. It's slow heading into the city over the Bay Bridge. The drive time from the Maze to Fremont, 32 minutes. Richmond San Rafael Bridge westbound. Once you get on the bridge, it's not bad, but the approach in Richmond, very slow from 23rd Street. Peter Finch for KQED.
Support for KQED comes to us this morning from Style Bath and Kitchen, a locally owned business bringing tailored kitchens and bathrooms to life for over 25 years with brands such as Toto and California Faucets. Listeners can learn more by searching Style Bath and Kitchen online. Another Planet Entertainment presenting Tedeschi Trucks Band at the Greek Theater in Berkeley on May 31st and June 1st with special guest Little Feet. Tickets on sale now at Ticketmaster.com. Singing lessons can be too expensive for some kids, but a nonprofit called ArtSmart provides free lessons and mentoring to young singers in Philadelphia and other cities. That story is coming up on Morning Edition on KQED. Here and now, coming up later at 11 after Forum.
I'm Robin Young. Just about everyone carries a cell phone, so why do some people hang on to their landlines?
I find my landline's receiver much easier to hold than my flat rectangle of a cell phone.
There's also lousy coverage in some places, and phone companies are hoping to cut the cord to landlines. That's next time, here and now.
Can't let go of POTS, Plano Telephone Service. We'll have it the latest on that story. Conversations and the latest news all ahead on Here and Now. 2 hours for you today, 11 to 1.
Stephen King has written dozens of horror novels, and he says taking a story too far? Not possible.
I found out, to sort of my delight and sort of to my horror, that you can't really gross out the American public.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. My conversation with Stephen King about his new collection of short stories on All Things Considered from NPR News.
1 o'clock today, then the world at 2.
In a German city far from any ocean, there's a river that people love to surf. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll take you urban surfing in Munich next time on The World.
Support for NPR comes from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. C3.ai. Uma, cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And the listeners and sustainers of KQED. Good morning, I'm Dave Freeman at 7:46.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A lot of young people are talented singers and could benefit from private music lessons, which are expensive. And that's where a nonprofit called ArtSmart comes in. ArtSmart offers one-on-one tuition-free music lessons. It's a program that was launched in Philadelphia and is now lifting voices in cities across the country. Reporter Buffy Gorilla introduces us to two singers.
In 2020, Jernae Barnes was a freshman at Franklin Learning Center in Philadelphia. All her classes were online, including choir. It was hard to stay excited for school until she saw a post from her choir teacher about ArtSmart.
You guys should really audition for this ArtSmart program, and I actually just took the chance and followed through with it.
Barnes comes from a musical family, and she grew up singing in church, but never had formal training. So with the confidence that comes from knowing you can do multiple takes, Barnes submitted this video, which now makes her cringe.
He's gonna fulfill every promise I made. Don't give up on God.
Lucas De Jesus is an ArtSmart mentor. He watched Barnes's video.
I remember your audition specifically. I could see the passion coming through your face, and I remember being in love with it because it was so authentic.
Barnes was paired with De Jesus when she landed a spot on the program.
I kind of just hoped to have someone who was really passionate about what they were doing and someone that was willing to meet me where I was at.
16-year-old Nevaeh Fires describes herself as shy, even though she's in two bands. Like Barnes, she auditioned as a freshman, but she had to audition in person.
I was nervous, I'm not gonna lie.
She's a huge fan of Disney musicals and sang Part of Your World from The Little Mermaid. Fires has worked with her mentor, Andrew Moneth, since last year. ArtSmart puts a lot of effort into matching students with their mentors.
I feel like I had to build a relationship with Mr. Andrew. I learned to kind of like try to trust myself. I think it's just learning to become comfortable with who I have because they're really just here to help me out. Let's do part of your world.
All right, part of your world. Stand up nice and tall.
Now, once a week, she gets to practice with a professional.
Bright young women, sick of swimming, ready to stand and ready to know what the people know.
Nevaeh Fires has more music in her future. She still has a couple more years in high school, so more time to keep singing. Jernay Barnes has her sights set on college.
The plan is to go to Berklee College of Music in Boston. I just want to, you know, use my voice as a tool and also to teach.
There's an audition. She's considering dusting off her go-to audition song one more time.
God is able to do just what he said he would do. He's gonna fulfill every promise to you. Don't give up on God, cause he
won't. And ArtSmart will welcome new talent next year, ready to put their voices to work. For NPR News, I'm Buffy Gorilla in Philadelphia.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Peter Finch checking in again with the latest Bay Area traffic.
A new crash in Oakland, eastbound 580 before Beaumont Avenue. Two cars involved. It's not clear if any lanes are blocked there. We're also getting a report now of eastbound 580 before Central Avenue. That would be in the Richmond area. Two-vehicle crash there on the right shoulder. And in Marin County, it's slow going right now. Southbound 101 Novato to downtown San Rafael. The slowing starts at Roland. Peter Finch for KQED.
Morning traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. It's the Marketplace Morning Report ahead at 7:51. Coming up for you on this Tuesday, a continuation of their series looking at the so-called news deserts where local news is scant. This morning, a look at legislation in several states designed to support local journalism efforts. And insurance companies are just beginning to assess the extent of damage to Houston area homes after a severe windstorm delivered major damage there. This comes at a time when insurance premiums have been rising and some homeowners have lost private coverage altogether. The latest at 7:51.
I'm Amna Nawaz. On the next news hour, talk show host Bill Maher reflects on his controversial brand of comedy and commentary. That's Tuesday on the PBS News Hour.
The news on KQED, PBS News Hour at 3. On a new episode of The Porter, Jr. finds himself in debt to notorious Chicago gangster Miss Queenie. Lucy's new relationship impacts her career, and Marlene makes an unlikely friend. The Porter, tonight, watch it at 9 p.m. on KQED+. We wrapped up our spring membership drive recently. We didn't quite meet our goal, but if you didn't have a chance to give, you can still do so. Just go to kqed.org/donate. Thank you, and don't forget to choose a thank you gift.
Disaster insurance is great, if you can find it.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Total Wine and More. Total Wine and More, helping shoppers love what they find at TotalWine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia or North Carolina. Drink responsibly. Be 21. And by UKG. UKG is a partner that delivers HR, pay, time, and culture solutions designed to help build a great workplace for everyone. UKG, our purpose is people.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. People who live around Houston, Texas, are in rebuilding mode after a major windstorm damaged cars, businesses, and homes last week. Their insurers are just starting to put a dollar number to the destruction. That insurance, though, is getting more expensive and harder to even find at all. In Houston, Marketplace's Elizabeth Trovo has that.
In the wake of the storm, insurance claims are flooding in, says Rich Johnson with the Insurance Council of Texas.
Fallen trees, whether it's on homes or automobiles, a lot of broken windows.
The storm is just another extreme weather event affecting the region. It's coming after 2 years of double-digit increases in homeowners' insurance rates. Johnson says it's because storms are stronger and more frequent and...
It's compounded by the economy, you know, the cost of building materials, the cost of labor.
Beyond increased costs, more Texans are struggling to find any private home insurance. That's pushing them into the Texas FAIR plan, the state's residential insurance plan of last resort.
The private insurance market, for whatever reasons, is starting to retract from writing coverage.
Anna Stafford is with the Texas FAIR Plan Association. Over the last year, she's seen roughly a 32% increase in people turning to these last resort policies.
That could be due to the impact of weather events that we've experienced in the state.
Hundreds in the Houston area have filed claims with the state plan since the windstorm, and hurricane season starts next month. In Houston, I'm Elizabeth Trovall for Marketplace.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is in Europe this week. She's trying to convince U.S. allies to use seized Russian assets to help Ukraine. Yellen delivered a speech this morning in Frankfurt, Germany. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the details.
In the speech, Yellen says it's vital and urgent that the U.S. and its allies find a way to unlock the value of frozen Russian sovereign assets to help Ukraine. Yellen will continue trying to convince them at the G7 finance ministers meeting this week in Italy. She says this will be a key topic. The U.S. plan reportedly involves using the interest earned on the frozen Russian funds for Ukraine aid. Congress passed the Repo Act earlier this year. That gives President Biden the authority to seize Russian funds frozen in the U.S. to aid Ukraine. But Yellen needs the EU's help because most of Moscow's frozen assets are in Europe. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is up 36 points. That's about a tenth of a percent. The S&P 500 is up less than a tenth of a percent. The NASDAQ is down less than a tenth of a percent.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. With Schwab investing themes, people can invest in ideas they believe in, like artificial intelligence, renewable energy, pet passion, and more. Over 40 themes to choose from. More at schwab.com. And by The Economist, devoted to providing independent journalism that makes sense of the news shaping the world. More at economist.com or with The Economist app, newsletters, and podcasts.
This election year, we've been focusing on the business models of local news, when they work and when they do not. There are more than 200 counties where there is no substantial local news source at all. Today, we're looking at legislation in several states that's designed to support local journalism. Ken Doctor is a news industry analyst. He's also the founder of the Pulitzer Prize-winning local news outlet Lookout Santa Cruz in California. Ken Doctor spoke with my Marketplace colleague, David Brancaccio.
States creating legislation to help firm up local news. I want to turn first East Coast, New York. The state's budget for next year allocates, I think it's $90 million worth of tax credits. That sit well with you?
I think it's the best solution that's out there at the moment. Tax credits for actually hiring journalists that are determined through basically the tax system, so you don't have legislators or governors picking winners or losers, seems to be the best alternative. There, it's $30 million a year for 3 years, and it goes pretty equally to larger and smaller sites. So this is something that's being watched, and of course, in California, something similar is now in consideration.
Yeah, so in California, I saw there were several bills, I think, being considered by the legislature. Any of those stand out for you?
Well, there's two major ones. There was one that was passed by the California Assembly last year, popularly known as a link tax, passed the assembly, then got a hailstorm of opposition and slowed down. So a lot of publishers are very concerned they would lose a lot of traffic, even if they might gain some revenue from that tax. And the one that is very current today is Senate Bill 1327. And that bill is much more similar to the New York bill. It would provide tax credits for retaining and a little additional for hiring new journalists.
Just so people understand, on the previous measure, the link tax, the mechanics of it would be I don't know. David Brancaccio, journalist, writes a great piece about news deserts. And some other media, let's say Facebook, links to it. They might have to pay a little fee for that?
Yeah, a little fee times millions and millions. So Facebook plainly decided they didn't need news and they weren't going to pay it. And so they got out of it. In Canada, they're saying the same thing would happen in the U.S. And in California if it happened. Facebook has contributed about 20% plus or minus to news sites traffic. But Google's the big player. It is 25 to 50% of all of the traffic that comes to news websites in the U.S. So if they were to pull out of news links, that would be a huge hit to audience. So news publishers are really trying to figure out a way forward once again in a very unstable environment.
There's more on all of this at Ken Doctor's site, newsonomics.com. He's also author of the book Newsonomics, 12 New Trends That'll Shape the News You Get. Ken, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
That was David Brancaccio. And in New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Morning Edition.